White Noise Podcast. We show entertainment stuff. Billy and Seth, David and Billy, and David and Seth, and Billy again. This is the best show in the entire world. Movies, TV, video games. Enjoy the show. Hello, everyone. Welcome to White Noise Weekly. We got a loaded show for you guys today. A lot to talk about. Seth is not here. I don't have a Halo-related excuse for him not being here like David, but you know, I'm sure he's probably rewatching Daredevil because David hasn't seen Daredevil. He's upset. Maybe that's why he's not here. He doesn't want to talk to someone who still hasn't finished Daredevil yet, David.
I think maybe he's quit the show in protest of my not watching. So I'll make sure it'll get done with the season, you know, this week before we get to the Hall of Fame halfway show, so I can at least have complete thoughts when we talk about it. Since I think that, surprisingly, Daredevil might actually be stacking up pretty well in your guys' opinions, I imagine, compared to what we've seen so far this year.
I mean, I think it's ahead of Game of Thrones and behind Better Call Saul. I guess to show exactly where it ranks or fits in for me right now.
But that's pretty remarkable, you know, seeing as you're a huge Game of Thrones fan. Yes, you were disappointed with this season, but at the same time, Daredevil really had to work pretty hard, and it had to be a pretty quality product for you to have those kind of high praise for it. And I liked it so far. Obviously, I can't make a complete opinion yet, but
I'm hoping everyone who, like you, if they read the descriptions on iTunes or Podomatic, whatever way they listen to this, if they read the descriptions, I usually include that you had still not seen Daredevil, because it seems to come up at least once every episode. So I like the fact that we're introducing this by talking about the fact that you have still not seen Daredevil.
Yeah, and we're using it in a relevant way since we do have that Hall of Fame podcast coming up soon,
which I'm sure all the listeners are really excited for. My dad was actually pointing this out to me as one of our loyal listeners, how we need some way of showing everybody what the Hall of Fame is currently, so it's not just what way they select last time. So next time I'll definitely make sure, but I think we need to make a website or something where we can A, have the Hall of Fame, but B, have all of our ratings for stuff on the David scale.
That would be a good point, actually. The David scale is the holy word on this show for criticism.
the official scale we use here. It's kind of like certain countries have certain currencies they have to use or certain languages.
We have Dave stars.
Yeah, David stars. But anyways, I actually was thinking about this. So we have our theme song, which, you know, I worked very hard on it for like 3 minutes, 4 minutes.
You did?
And yeah, I kept thinking about, you know, this is, I bet 3 minutes on this, right? You know, it was fun, but it's whatever. It's just a theme song, and I enjoy it enough. But True Detective Season 2 has one of my, you know, the more interesting, unique theme songs. I really enjoy it. I like the background of it, too. And the title sequence. I've heard way too much criticism about a title sequence and theme song, which just tells you the attitude I think people are here with True Detective Season 2. Like, they just want to criticize it, or they're having fun hating on it. But I think I can say, as someone who's not obsessed with True Detective Season 1 like you are, which we nominated in the Hall of Fame on White Noise, but it's also, I really enjoyed it. Didn't absolutely love it, but I loved it. And going to True Detective Season 2, I didn't have super high expectations or super low. It was kind of like I'm curious to see what they do next after last year. But, I mean, season 2, Episode 1 was kind of a table setter for me. And yet, I can't believe the amount of criticism about how bad this is already. Like, I don't understand that.
Yeah, it's been really a kind of a disappointment to me to see the reaction, the angry mob mentality that's generated, because it seems that nowadays we kind of have a situation where the critics can set the status quo for the social media, just like standardization of opinion, and create an angry mob very quickly. And that's kind of
rabble.
What I've seen. Yeah.
Rabble.
You should have used that other song, rabble. The other song that was in the bar, rabble. Or if you're Seth, you should have stuck with, you know, the song by the Hanson Family. But yeah, I mean, I don't really understand why people are so critical right now of this show. It's the first episode. I know most of the critics have seen 3 episodes, and the ones that I've heard have said that it gets better in the next 2 episodes. But it is kind of bizarre. You see the Rotten Tomatoes score of 65% already. And also, I kind of have a little bit of a problem philosophically of judging a season after 3 episodes and like setting a review and having like a running score, because I think that kind of is inherently hurts the show's momentum and hurts maybe what it's trying to do without actually seeing the entirety of the work. I know you have to, for kind of technical and practical reasons, have that sort of review and process going on with each individual episode, but I think that we need to sit back, relax, enjoy what we were seeing, because I actually thought it was a very solid episode for table setting. Like a table setting episode, this is about as good as you can make a table setting episode. Not the best I've seen, but certainly no lower than, you know, your average episode of television. I would say it's above average. You know, I think both of you and I said it was between a B and a B plus.
Yeah, I think I gave it about, like, I guess a B, I think is what I said overall. And to me, it's almost impossible to give this episode a rating because of what it is. And I guess as we actually get to what happened, but Justin Lin directed this episode. He's going to direct, you know, the next second episode as well. And one unique thing about True Detective this year, as we talked about, they do not have the same director like they did last time for each episode. They have a different one, you know, each episode, but a lot of directors sometimes get two episodes. So I think it'll be interesting to see exactly how each episode differentiates between the director being different. But they decided that, you know, we have a new season. We have to reintroduce everything. You know, it's not like carryover from season one. So they put every kind of table-sitting aspect they can pretty much put into this in the entirety of this episode before the very end, which actually kind of starts the plot, in my opinion, in the very, like, you know, last couple minutes of the episode.
I mean, really, it was kind of the opposite of the, you know, the first episode of season one, where it opens up with that, with you seeing the case in progress and them, and you seeing the murder happen. This one's kind of the opposite. You have the characters being set up purely, and given their backgrounds and getting their associations and all their problems, and then you finally have the actual plot start at the end of the episode. A lot of people were turned off by that. They found it boring. They found it slow. But maybe that's intentional. Has anyone thought about that? That maybe it's intentional that they're going that kind of slow brooding pace with a really dark tone? I mean, this is a guy I feel like I need to give the benefit of the doubt. He did an excellent job with, you know, season one of True Detective of writing a really compelling story. And we're already writing him off.
Yeah, he did the entire thing by himself. He clearly has some form of vision which he's going to portray here. I'm not exactly worried based off one episode that was table setting. Like, this is like saying that you're disappointed by the opening part of a movie before, like, the opening title sequence happens, when you're not really entirely sure what's going on, because that's how I kind of feel with this episode. It's, okay, we have a lot of background information we need to get into, but we don't want to, you know, spread that out too much because there's a lot of characters here. So we're just going to put it all in the first episode. And that was kind of, it was kind of an issue to me, how the fact that it was, A, kind of scatterbrained.
It was.
The way things. And you had, I think the problem is you have four main characters compared to two last year. So you can't, you know, to really get into these different characters, you're spending a lot of time with each one. And it was like, okay, this person, you know, has a very dark backstory here, and this one has a very dark backstory here, and this one has a very dark backstory here. And I can get, like, why that stuff wasn't very appealing. But, I mean, that's kind of the tone the show wants to go, and we really shouldn't have expected anything different.
No, I mean, I completely agree with you there. I think the scatterbrained thing, maybe that's kind of intentional, that's being convoluted. Maybe that's kind of the, either he's trying to make, you know, some people said he's trying to make, you know, a dream, kind of a dream atmosphere, kind of like David Lynch does with his movies, and kind of make it a little bit intentionally convoluted so you don't really exactly know what's going on or what direction the show's going to take. And then a lot of it actually is conventional still. I mean, the first season of True Detective was kind of an unconventional take on a conventional material with a buddy cop story. This one's kind of going more of a police procedural, but taking it into an unconventional dark way. I mean, I'm fascinated. I mean, it did the job for me of making me interested and want to see that second episode, which I would have obviously wanted to do that regardless. But I think even as an average viewer of television going into there, I don't think it deserved the criticism it got. And I think it did a decent enough job of introducing us to that world, giving us at least somewhat an idea of these characters, even though two of them haven't gotten the same service, you know, Colin Farrell and Vince Vaughn had in this episode. But you still kind of have an idea of who these characters are on a surface level. And I'm interested to see where they take this story going forward.
Well, I want to start off with probably my favorite two elements of this episode, which obviously, I mean, ignoring like the, you know, technical aspects, like the acting and production, you know, levels are going to be high quality. But in terms of the story standpoint, one, the Vince Vaughn storyline, which I actually have, you know, Wikipedia open right now, so I can kind of like all the names. It's Frank
Simeon.
Simeon.
Yeah.
Simeon. It's S-E-M-Y-O-N, so I wasn't entirely sure.
It's not
sure
Simon.
The,
it's not a typo. It's called Simeon. It's his
Simeon,
name.
Okay. So Frank Simeon, he is a mob business type leader who, he has a city manager, Ben Caspier, disappears, according to Wikipedia. He disappears the day before he's supposed to have plans with him for a new light rail. And it's kind of interesting because you have essentially an incorporated city. The city of Vinci is, it's not really a real city. They kind of, the mobster business leaders of the area kind of made a real city.
And it's kind of a joke. There's a joke later on in the episode too, at the very end, where Colin Farrell, you know, they're saying like, where the hell is Vinci? What the hell is that? And he goes, it's a city, supposedly. I mean, I thought that was like a really funny way to tackle that concept, because he's right. And you're right. You know, it's kind of a way they've incorporated their own city. Everything's kind of a sham. It's organized by these mobsters and these illegal activities.
And what's really kind of fascinating is, you know, Simeon, he seems like a good guy with a good family life, and he's like a nice guy.
He's the most stable of all of the characters that we've seen so far, and he's the villain.
He's the villain, right? He seems like the villain. It's kind of interesting because my favorite part of the episode had everything to do with Velcoro, who is Colin Farrell's character, and you see him. What happens is essentially a flashback. Everyone who is listening to this should have probably have seen it, but spoilers. But you introduce him. He essentially his wife was raped, right?
Yes.
And he has a son who is very likely the product of rape because him and his wife are having trouble, getting her pregnant. And it's very likely that the son is probably raped, but he's kind of in denial about whether it's his son or not.
He doesn't
care.
He says he wants it his son, and he feels very attached to this kid. And it's a really bizarre relationship with CFM. He's kind of ashamed, I think, underneath the surface in some regards. And he's trying to make up for that by, like, raising his son the way that he wants him to be, even though, his son is like a fat ginger kid who's kind of a wimp from what we've seen. And he gets bullied, and it's really sad to see his reaction. And then, Frank's and Ray Velcoro goes over there and, shakes him up and demands the name of the bully that stole his shoes that he bought him.
Says some horrible things to his son.
Yeah, some horrible things.
Out of love, though. And he beats the crap out of the young boy's father.
Giving some iconic lines that we can't really repeat on this show.
They're very graphic, yeah.
We don't have Seth here to say those.
But it's a shame because he walks into, the area that Vince Vaughn's character, Simeon, is at, and you have, the red lighting in the background, the two big guys. It seems like he's, either signing a deal with the devil and kind of walking into the hell of the area, which is kind of interesting symbolism how they did that. But I still haven't seen exactly what Simeon is bad. So these two characters are very fascinating because, one, you have a guy who seems like a good guy, but he's the bad guy. So I'm wondering if he'll have the, going back to Daredevil, his Wilson Fisk smashing a guy's head in with a car moment. Some of the next two episodes really establish who this guy is, because maybe he's a good guy, but he's a good guy who does illegal criminal activity. Well, I guess we'll see that. It's kind of interesting. But Velcoro, I think, did the best job in terms of all the criticism you could have of this episode. I think he had the most engrossing, interesting plot line where you knew what his motivations are. You know why he is the way he is now based off his past events and the way he's still kind of in denial, and which you can see every day through his son, in a way, seeing his son. It's just a fascinating plot line that I really can't wait to see exactly how his character acts, because the way it was acted, the way it was portrayed, the way it was introduced, I don't think they could have done much better job in the first episode.
And I think when you compare that and the amount of time and time that was given to Velcoro's character, even Frank Simeon's character, you look at Rachel McAdams playing Annie and Taylor Kish playing his character, Paul Woodrow, I think his name, I can't remember exactly, I think it's Paul Woodrow's his character's name,
Paul
the other
Rube,
two
yeah.
detectives, and they're not given quite as much time as those other, as those other power, main characters. So I think it's a little quick that we jump and say that these are going to be, two-dimensional caricatures that aren't going to be given any depth. We've only had one episode, and it was a jam-packed episode. They gave us a lot of background for those other two guys. But from what we did hear about these characters was pretty interesting, in my opinion. I mean, Annie, named after Antigone by her crazy hippie father.
Antigone Bezerides like that.
Yeah, exactly. And it fits, and I think some of her background was done a little bit too much exposition, as we've talked about before. Because, hear them outwardly talking about the drama that's been in her background. I mean, you see her sister, and probably, in my opinion, the worst scene in the episode was when she was after a really good scene where you get a lot of insight into her character and the way she acts when she goes through this raid and this webcam sex shop, basically. And she gets all the she busts that up, and then she finds out her sister's a member of it. And then that scene was kind of a little bit rushed, in my opinion, and a little bit too on the nose.
So this is kind of like, I guess we'll go get to her character, and then obviously a Taylor Kish character. This is where I understand some of the criticisms were, but just for this episode, granted it's the first episode, I think everyone needs to take everything into context and perspective of what we're dealing with here. But yeah, it was kind of weird because it was not only going the four different characters going back and forth, but it's like McAdams' character to me, and this isn't fair to say this, but I kind of get the impression that I was like, okay, all the criticism of the way they, betrayed Monahue, what's your name?
Michelle Monaghan's character, yeah.
Yeah, Monaghan. Like, the way they betrayed her character season one, it seems like those criticisms kind of manifest themselves into McAdams' character, where, she has an estranged father and sister, and, that's the main thing we know about her background, but because of that,
she's the dominant force in her own life.
Yeah, because of that, she's dominant force in her own life, so she's very high-strung, gambling, drinking late at night, into some kinky sex, very violent. It's you know, that's because of, it seems like, like I said, it's a direct counteractive to the criticism of season one, which kind of makes sense.
Because Pizzolatto, he wrote
this
all himself, and he had a ton of, in my opinion, unjust criticisms that were undeserved about his female characters, because his stories were about those two detectives. And so, of course, you know, the rest of the characters didn't exactly get the same kind of depth, but he did a decent job with it, I think, still. And I think it's kind of unjust, and I think there's definitely a chance that maybe he was responding to that criticism by making a new female detective and Annie. But still, she might actually be my favorite character so far.
She is the, I think McAdams is too good of an actor to be on television, which sounds a little weird, because obviously television, when I say that, I mean the traditional sense, because people think movie stars should be on TV. Obviously, movie stars should be on TV as well as a different kind of medium, but she's so talented, it's almost absurd how good of an actress McAdams is in every single scene, and I can't imagine she won't get an Emmy like as a lock.
Yeah, I mean, she does a really good job of, like, playing this character not too on the nose and not too over the top, but still kind of showing that toughness and that kind of dominance that this character exhibits in her life, over the men in her lives. And she's already definitely, to me, made clear who her character is and how deep this character is going to be. Even if the writing doesn't match up, a lot of her performance can make up for that.
Yeah, but what's one of the problem is you saw her character where it's like, I kind of wish something, there was something more. I'll get, once I go over Woodrow or Kish's character, I'll explain, I guess, my problem with this episode. But Woodrow's character is interesting because, you know, he clearly has issues with intimacy based off, you know, the fact he had to take, I guess, Viagra in order to get up with
his blue
girlfriend.
Pill. His beautiful girlfriend, his beautiful hot girlfriend. Like, literally the most beautiful girl you can see. It's an interesting situation, and I mean, I don't want us to just hop to speculation on why he's doing this, because that's going to be interesting to see how the episode unfolds. That's kind of a little bit too shallow of discussion. But, I mean, definitely his performance in this, I thought he did a pretty good job. I think, you know, he didn't really get as much material. Like, him and Annie didn't get nearly as much material as Ray Velcoro or Frank Simeon. But with what they did, I thought they did a good job with their acting of, you know, creating personalities for these characters and showing us the trouble they were going through and their dark past and all that stuff.
I love how you keep interjecting the positives before I can even get to any negatives, which is kind of like, I mean, I know, like, you've read a lot of criticism. You've sent me a lot of texts about how people are, you know, rationally criticizing the show, I feel. But it's interesting because, like I said, he definitely has a self-destructive tendency based off, you know, whatever in his past. And, you know, he has he was a military guy. We do know that as well. Mm-hmm. It was a very interesting scene where the celebrity, the actress, he pulled over in the car.
Yeah. She propositions him for sex.
Yeah, it's a very interesting scene. I don't really know a ton about him, but I kind of feel the one issue I have with the show so far is, right, we talk about this again off air, but which we keep saying because we talk about the show a lot.
Yeah.
We talk about the show a lot.
We've talked about leading up to it. We've talked about our anticipation for it. We actually might talk about this show maybe more than we did Game of Thrones during the season of Game of Thrones.
Yeah, it's agree. So this... It's a lot of talking about the show, and the one thing we think is last season, Marty's character, which is Woody Harrelson, Marty, he kind of was a grounded character, where he obviously was a womanizer, that was the main issue, and he had a lot of stereotypical detective tendencies, what you expect, you know, dominant male type, et cetera, but...
He still had some optimism.
He was optimistic, he would crack jokes all the time to his other cops, and he was a normal person we kind of relate to, even like I said, he was a womanizer, but he was a grounded character, who allowed, you know, Matthew McConaughey to be Russ Cole. And the thing about Russ Cole was, he had a weird, weird, weird view on life. And he's a very unique character in the different, you know, what he believed in his certain perspectives. But I never thought, I was like, well, this is like the most depressing character I've ever seen. Comparatively, one episode in, I've seen three characters who've only really symbolized dark tendencies with dark backstories. And there's not much optimism at all to me between these three different characters. It's like, and that's why I'm kind of curious, like, how can they make this show really work within this world without making it completely depressing to watch?
I mean, it is a good point. It's a really tough balance to strike. And, I mean, Marty Hart, I mean, we kind of underrate how good Woody Harrelson was in that role. I mean, you've mentioned before just how you thought he really did a great job with adding nuance to a character that could have been completely outshone by Matthew McConaughey's amazing character and Russ Cole because of the way they're written completely differently. But the way that Marty Hart, you know, his character was and the way that Woody Harrelson played him kind of grounded the situation and gave us perspective on exactly what Russ Cole was talking about and seeing the reaction from Marty Hart, you know, and keeping that in perspective, you know, calling him crazy, the little jokes they had back and forth. It really allowed Russ Cole to flourish and also keep the show in a perspective that, you know, in every man who doesn't have an extremely pessimistic point of view could still enjoy and watch the show and understand.
So I guess overall, I mean, you probably enjoyed the episode a little more. You were kind of in the same boat. I think they did a very good job considering what they had to do, but there was some issues with it. But it's, like I said, the first episode, there's seven more to go. They did a lot of table setting. I just don't like the overreactions to what we could be a very good show. Maybe not. I don't know. But that's the point. We don't really know at this point. And I think, you know, after one episode, I'm not, like, not wanting to
watch
it anymore.
We're not jumping ship.
I'm not disappointed. Yeah.
Certainly not a 65% on Rotten Tomatoes. I mean, are you kidding me? It's a little bit – I know what Rotten Tomatoes is. It's not exactly – you know, 65% doesn't mean how good the show is, but it means how many people liked it and how many people disliked it. And I think we need to just kind of sit back and relax a little bit and try to enjoy this ride and see where the show takes us. Because, I mean, the plot's really going to start going these next two episodes, and we're actually going to get to see what this show's trying to do.
Yeah, and, I mean, it's still a HBO high-quality show that has
great acting.
Four very recognizable actors in it. Like I said, I think that's the main issue, is you have four actors, four main parts that you want to get incorporated in the first episode, and that's hard. And that's kind of why you got this, but interesting enough, it's a good segue, I guess, to the rest of HBO's lineup. So you have these four great actors and actresses, and then you immediately go into, you know, Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, and Jack Black in the next episode. There's a couple other guys, you know, John David Washington's Denzel Washington's son, I believe.
Rob Corddry's in it, too, I think. And
Rob Corddry's in it, yeah.
I mean,
he's a silly guy in a lot of movies. And a lot of TV shows.
I mean, you and I talked about before these, you know, this lineup aired on Sunday that this might have been, on paper, the most impressive back-to-back-to-back lineups of actors and you know, high-profile names that we've seen on television.
Pretty much. This is HBO's TV lineup for 2 hours. You'll see six super high-profile actors and actresses. That's ignoring the rest of the different parts who are very... like, if you watch The Brink, you know, Tim Robbins is in that as well. Yeah. There's a lot of very notable small side actors you see in that show as well. And it's interesting because True Detective, regardless whether you like that or not, Ballers and The Brink were not better. In fact, they're both significantly worse. Ballers, at least, I don't know. The premiere did a lot of table setting as well. It was possible it could be a fun show. I didn't love the opening.
I mean, I thought it was going to be a disaster. I didn't think it was going to be very good at all. But I liked The Rock. And
we didn't get
much
of The Rock
in this
episode.
I think it was a miss. I mean, I was somewhat surprised pleasantly, but to me, it's still, I'm not necessarily chomping at the bit to see the next episode. And then The Brink was not good at all. In fact, it was bad. So they're 1-for-3 on this lineup that on paper we thought was going to be excellent.
And when we say 1-for-3, I mean, people are still, you know, True Detective, if the reviews are right, this is not, like, I don't know, it doesn't seem like this night.
For White Noise, they're 1-for-3.
For White Noise, 1-for-3. But it's kind of funny. It's like, this is a star-studded lineup that no one's happy with. But at least, you know,
although
it's
Seth actually
Ballers.
Seth liked it. Let's speak for Seth. Seth did like Ballers. And if you follow his opinions more closely than ours, then maybe you should check it out and enjoy it. So I wish he was here to kind of, you know, bring some perspective and bring the other side of the argument here.
Well, I mean, it's one episode. I don't really want to judge this. I'm like, we'll get to The Brink in a second. I don't really want to judge Ballers after one episode.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got, you know, Peter Berg directed it. And I love Peter Berg. Guy did Friday Night Lights, did a lot of the 30 for 30 documentaries. And I think it could be very intriguing. Like I said, there wasn't much of The Rock in this episode. You had to establish these other characters, like John David Washington, his character, Ricky Jarrett. He's a pro athlete who, you know, had a dumb incident where he was one of the better wide receivers, apparently, in the NFL. But he actually, not accidentally, but he punched some guy who was giving him crap
at
a club. And that caused him to kind of get lose his job. And then he signed with the Dolphins after some kind of amusing scenes. And then you have Omar Benson Miller plays Charles Green, who's a former offensive lineman kind of searching for the next step in his career. And he had some interesting scenes as well, but I didn't really laugh much during the show.
Yeah, and I thought it was going to be kind of a comedy. I mean, the drama stuff was almost more interesting than the comedy. And after you watch True Detective, you're kind of looking to laugh. You're kind of looking for something to cheer you up
that's
after that depressing hour of television.
I wish it could have done more, but it was one episode, and a lot of shows kind of find their stride after, you know, first couple episodes, and it seemed like a promising enough intro to it that I'm going to probably tune in next week and watch
Me
it,
too.
Especially because we're after True Detective and it's HBO. But The Brink was, like, okay, this is why I think The Brink was bad, okay? Ignore what they're trying to do as a satire about a, you know, political crisis in Pakistan involving U.S. intelligence, which is obviously Jack Black, who's Jack Black. He plays Jack Black in this. That's the best way to put it. I can't really describe it any
well. First of all, it's not exactly a punctual topic. It's something that that we're a little bit further past. You know, and it probably could have. The topic might have nailed a little bit better if it was done, you know, 5 years ago.
The geopolitical crisis in Pakistan is not exactly what you think. But here is kind of my main, I guess, issue with this. Okay, so you're looking at the three main characters, in my opinion, right? That you're looking at, and it's obviously Asif Menavi, I think is his name, and he works with he was a Jack Black a lot, right, at the embassy. Right. He's very important as well. But to me, it was like, okay, you have Jack Black, who's this obviously crazy, crude, you know, lowly foreign service officer who happens to get, you know, right situation.
Just like all his characters.
Yeah, of course, right? But then you have Tim Robbins, who's like the U.S. Secretary of State, who, of course, they introduce him with some, you know, Asian hook. By the way, between the Ballers and the Brink, I probably got my HBO designated amount of nudity and sex. There was a lot. There was a law in these first episodes. You know, which they're pilots. You have to. It's like a HBO checkbox you have to have. But, you know, they have that. But then they have Tim Robbins, who he's... I didn't find any of his stuff that funny. Like, he made a bunch of inappropriate comments while working for the government. He made a bunch of inappropriate comments, you know, talking to his assistant. And I don't know, I didn't really find his stuff that funny. I mean, I guess it was kind of maybe slightly amusing.
I don't know. I was not that entertained by it. I mean, I think after watching Ballers, I'm willing to give it another episode to see if I like it. This one, I'm almost just willing just not even to watch the next one, to just wait to see how it goes and wait to see what the reaction to the episodes become. If they become better, I might tune in and see another episode, but I'm not particularly interested in continuing on with it.
Yeah,
after seeing one episode, which is what you want the pilot to do. You want it to, hook you.
I didn't get to, like, the worst part of it. So, like, obviously, I didn't like Tim Robbins stuff, Secretary of State. I didn't like Jack Black stuff at all. Even though, I guess I slightly laughed at the, where he was in, like, the different Pakistani house, and they were speaking a language he couldn't understand, obviously, and they're talking about, like, turning him in because they knew he was CIA. I guess I kind of laughed at that a little bit, but not really. But they have this character, Pablo Schreiber. He plays a drug dealer in the U.S. Navy Air Force,
he's a pilot,
essentially.
Yeah.
He's a U.S. Naval aviator.
Yeah, he's a naval aviator.
And, and then he's called Z-Pak, and he's a drug dealer. I didn't find a single aspect of that entire plotline funny at all. I did not.
No.
I didn't laugh once.
And you feel like there's some material there, and, you know, it feels like there's material in this subject that you could make funny. But it's just not looking promising at all.
It's like this could have been more of a disaster if the casting, the acting wasn't so great, but it really kind of was a disaster. This is essentially political satire with no bite.
I mean, when you're looking at HBO comedies, I mean, the one that stands out to me, the one I love the most, is Eastbound and Down. I thought that show was hilarious. It was crude still, but it was a great show, and it was hilarious. And that's kind of what I was hoping to see, kind of a return to that HBO comedy that I love with these last two shows we were talking about. And it's not looking
that's
like we're going to be getting to that level.
That's because Danny McBride is a special human being.
Yeah, it's true. And that character was perfect for him. And also the Will Ferrell cameos were great. Matthew McConaughey was in that, too, for a couple of episodes.
Is that the one where, like, he, like, what's his name? He's also in This is the End as well.
Yeah.
Craig Robinson. Craig Robinson stands there between them, and he's like, I was making sweet laugh to my love, and my young son Gabriel walks in.
And I was like, no, let him watch my son, my seed.
He's like, let the boy watch, as I learned from my father. And he learned from his father before it, which, like, I saw the outtakes for that, and
I'm sure we're completely wrong, but there was a scene that was remotely like that that made me laugh.
It was really, really, if you haven't seen it, like I said, just look up that scene, outtakes YouTube, probably the funniest thing I've ever seen. But anyways, that show was a special show. HBO is
not like
trying
these.
It. No, HBO is definitely trying to bring in these star-starring talents, you know, and directors and actors. But we'll see. I don't know. It's kind of real. It's one episode. We can't really over-criticize, but I don't want to watch The Brink again after one episode. I just don't.
Yeah. It's just
I'll watch more John
too
Oliver.
Too crude and not too funny.
Yeah, John Oliver's great. I'll watch that, you know?
Yeah, that's a great way to end the night.
Yeah, anyways, moving on. So we real quick wanted Game of Thrones, just one small discussion that we've been, you know, thinking about here. And I am not happy as a book reader myself, right? And along with the person who watched the show, but I was not very happy with the way the season ended because it, one, bothered me about how they kind of ruined material I don't even know about really in the book to one degree, but I was unhappy with the resolution of certain plot lines. So you had an interesting question, David, about that.
Yeah, I was going to say, as a book reader, would you have preferred for George R. R. Martin not to tell anything to the producers after he knew, or to the writers and producers after he knew the show was going to overtake Game of Thrones, you know, Game of Thrones books, and let them think of their own things that fit with the show, while George R. R. Martin just continued on with his plan in the books, and have basically two separate universes, diverging events that were completely different from each other since neither of them would have knowledge of the other's intent? Or would you prefer this situation where George R. R. Martin has told the two writers, I can't remember their names exactly, but...
Or, you know, Benioff and Weiss.
Yeah, hasn't told, you know, Weiss and Benioff about the ending. I mean, which would you prefer?
So here's my thought process.
I knew the answer.
Okay, so here's my thought process. One, I think the ending will probably be amazing because George R. Martin thought of the ending ahead of time and he told them the ending. But here's the problem. They know what the end game is. They know what has to happen. But the problem is they want to keep certain actors and certain characters around.
Right.
So this is where this season was kind of wasted. Like, okay, Brienne, we have to include her even though she doesn't really do anything, right? Okay, Jaime. He goes off to Dorne.
And does stuff.
And does stuff so we can keep him around because we don't know what else to do with him. Okay, Sansa. We're pretty much making up material at this point because she's just sitting at the Vale right now. I know. She'll be with her. And a huge misfire, in my opinion, because as much as you like Ramsay, I didn't like the Ramsay stuff as much. But it was also more like just the way they went with Sansa. I didn't like the direction they went there. You know, they didn't know what to do with it, but she had to do something. Yeah, she had to do something. And that's what they decided. And that's the problem.
So just to have her get raped. I mean, that's the solution if you're the Game of Thrones writers. But
it's just they knew what the ending was, and they had to plot a map there. And I think they were great at adapting material, for sure. They were phenomenal adapting material. They had a lot of great original dialogue, you know, in the earlier seasons. But to me, it's almost like an impossible task to figure out how to map this road there while keeping these characters on the show. And that was really the big issue, because all the characters they tried to keep on the show that they didn't know what to do with, all those plot lines didn't work very well. And even, like, Daenerys' stuff, even the book's Daenerys' stuff felt like, you know, they were stalling. So now you have multiple plot lines that kind of feel like they're just there for no reason. So, if they would have had their own material of what they were doing, like they could decide what these characters are going to happen to them, then it probably would have turned out better for certain plot lines.
You want me to give you a nightmare scenario for you? Like a nightmare scenario, something you don't want to think?
I don't want to think about that.
You know what I'm trying to think? What if this is exactly what George R. R. Martin has told them that he's going to do? And that the scenes that we've seen where they've gone further than the books are actually what's going to happen in the books.
Nah, I can't imagine that battle.
Like, what could you imagine this?
Well, I mean, like, a lot of it's, like, I know a lot of it can't be in the books because there's slightly changed versions of it.
Sure, sure. But, I mean, like, the Stannis situation, for instance, or...
Yeah, it's very, what happens to Stannis is kind of very up in the air, because you don't actually have Stannis' viewpoint, you just get Davos. So you see Davos goes to, like, this other town to negotiate, he doesn't go to the Wall. So it's kind of an interesting situation where I'm not entirely sure what happened to Stannis, if I remember correctly.
But it is something that you have to think about and kind of like you have to be a little bit worried because, you mean, the books are now in a lot of storylines a lot further back than the show. And so if some of the stuff that's happening in the show is actually stuff that ends up happening in the books, I think readers are going to have some real problems with that because they really want – they're leaning on the fact that they think George R. R. Martin's vision has been distorted, that George R. R. Martin's material has been, you know, betrayed. But what if it's actually the opposite of that?
Well, it's interesting because I'm pretty sure Winds of Winter is the next book. They have leaked a lot of material. I do know, right, that they're like apparently he's like preparing to fight with the Boltons. You know, but there's a letter that to Jon from Ramsay Snow that said Stannis was killed, but no one really thought he was dead. It just seemed like a lie made up.
Wasn't it just a way to get Jon Snow to end up getting killed by to end up getting killed by the people at on the Wall? The Night's Watch.
Yeah. So I guess we'll see. I don't even know if Stannis... I mean, I don't think Stannis is dead right now because I feel like they would have showed it because they're not afraid to show characters.
Or what if he ends up? What if he does end up burning his daughter? I mean, there's a lot of weird things that could happen here that could like really really upset some readers.
But I'm sure they could have done. I feel like if they do that though in the books, because all like the terrible things that happen in the books, I feel like are always done in a better way. You know, I think the Red Wedding is more brutal in the show for sure.
Yeah.
But I feel like, you know, and you could argue similarly about like seeing Ned versus reading it. But for the most part, everything that's kind of new that they've done that was kind of terrible, like season 5 stuff that was just like hard to watch, or, you know, like, I can't believe they did that. They usually handle those kind of moments better in the books. And everything we saw season 1-4 was something that happened directly in the books. So I feel like they'll be handled fine in the books. You're right. I kind of almost wish they were different, you know, universes at this point, different, you know, branching paths, because that way they're not stuck with this roadmap and they can kind of write their own way.
For sure, for sure. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I've only read one of the books, so I mean, I don't have the perspective of view on this stuff, but it's definitely an interesting question to ask.
All right, moving on. We're not going to spend too much time on this because I have no idea who this guy is, but Tom Holland was cast as the new Spider-Man.
You know what? I learned today he's not actually from Holland. He's from the United Kingdom, so his name's kind of a little bit of misleading there. But this is the first time we've actually seen a legitimate teenager, even though he's an old teenager, about not to be. He's 19 years old, going to play Spider-Man.
Okay, you could have told me he was in One Direction. I would have believed you looking at him right now. Like, that's the I don't know, he's just a young 19-year-old British guy. I have no idea who he is.
With no experience.
Yeah, apparently he's in Heart of the Sea.
Apparently he's, if we're going to see him for the first time in Captain America Civil War, which is going to be before the new Spider-Man reboot. But this begs the question, I mean, I really don't have a problem with this because I have complete and utter faith in whatever Sony does now on. I think Sony really has their stuff together, and they can really turn Spider-Man around. What about you, Billy?
I mean, is Sony doing the, is it just directly Sony, or are they, like, working with Marvel?
I think they're working with Marvel for Civil War, actually, but because they're giving him the character, but I think they're doing the Spider-Man stuff on their own. I'm not entirely sure.
I just know the new
Spider-Man. I'm being sarcastic, obviously, because I think Sony's the worst the worst motion picture distribution and production company probably in Hollywood, but
I know that the new Spider-Man movie is going to be part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So my question was kind of like,
they are doing it together. I mean, they're collaborating. I'm sure they're having discussions between writers and Marvel. I mean, this is like one of the first times I actually do have a little bit of optimism regarding Spider-Man since the third movie in the Sam Raimi trilogy.
Okay, they're releasing a movie co-produced by Marvel Studios. That's what it is. That makes sense. Okay, that's why they're doing
that. But really, we have nothing really to say about Tom Holland. But
yeah, except he looks like he's from, I told you, like he looks like he's from One Direction or something. I will say this. I like the fact they cast the young guy, who I've never heard of, because I think the main issue I have with the newer Spider-Man, the reboot, was one, you know, Garfield always looked too Hollywood-y, too cool to me for Peter Parker, who's this, like, lame guy.
Tom Holland looks lame. Is that what you're telling me?
No, I'm just saying he could be lame, and I'm not going to, like,
he doesn't have a movie star persona. He doesn't have the movie star persona.
Yeah, Garfield's like, yeah, I'm like a skater boy, but, you know, I'm a nerd, but I'm a skater boy, and I'm kind of cool. Yeah, I don't know, I didn't like that stuff at all. I hated it. I really did. It made me so
No, the new Spider-Mans were terrible, and they're rebooting it now for the third time, but...
Yeah, the first, I mean, the Spider-Man reboot, whatever, Amazing Spider-Man, wasn't, like, awful or anything. It just wasn't good, and the second one was terrible.
Yeah, I mean...
We're not going to talk about that anymore. Let's just move on.
How many more years until they reboot it for a fourth time? Because they're probably going to reboot it again after the Marvel Universe ends up rebooting. Because then they're going to have to use a new Spider-Man again if they want to maintain the Marvel Universe. I mean, it's very bizarre what we have going on.
Speaking of
here.
Another thing, I don't want to think about Ted 2, which based off the trailers, I like Ted fine.
I loved that movie.
I thought it was pretty good. I was a little, you know, Seth MacFarlane. I'm kind of tired of at this point. It was a little over the top at times. It was funny. I laughed at Ted. And I literally, based off the trailers, had no interest in watching Ted 2. And based off the reviews, I really now...
The Tom Brady stuff was pretty funny.
And now, based off the reviews, I really have no interest in watching Ted 2.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting. I mean, I haven't really seen that many trailers recently on television for this movie. And it's an R-rated comedy, so you kind of think it would need some sort of buzz going around it for it to do well. Like, Ted 1 was kind of interesting because it was the first Seth MacFarlane, you know, debut feature film. And... It was an animated comedy, R-rated, with, you know, CGI effects and Mark Wahlberg in it. I mean, it was a recipe for success, and it ended up being the highest-grossing R-rated comedy of all time, I believe, or at least the opening was. This has bad reviews going into it. Seth MacFarlane's reputation has kind of not been as great as it used to be during that time. Like, his Family Guy has kind of gone downhill in terms of people's public opinion on it. You know, American Dad... Cleveland Show is a disaster. I mean, his...
Bob's Burgers, though. I'll give him that.
Yeah, Bob's Burgers is not MacFarlane, though. It's a different person, but...
It wasn't MacFarlane?
No, but then you look at, you know, his situation when he did the Oscar show, which I thought that was pretty funny, but it still had some bad reception from that. I mean, he's had some bad buzz and also A Million Ways to Die in the West. A lot of people did not like that movie. I think this could end up being kind of a flop. I mean, I might end up eating my words, but I think this might end up being a flop.
So essentially the one thing I thought I was respecting Seth MacFarlane for, I can't even respect him for.
Yeah.
Okay. I haven't really watched much of Bob's Burgers, except I've heard good things about it. But, yeah, it's – I mean, okay, its Metascore is like 50 right now apparently. But
this
it's like
terrible.
8 positive, 14 mixed, 8 negative. Rotten Tomatoes is 40-something. And the plot is, like, from what I understand, it's pretty much Ted wants to be considered, you know – he has
a person.
Soul,
it's
human,
like it's a social
married,
commentary
yeah.
aspect coming to it this time.
Yeah. But I don't know. Like I said, I have zero interest in watching it based on what I've seen. To a similar degree, I have zero interest in watching the Entourage movie based off the trailers, but that's a different point.
No, I mean, I'll probably go see Ted 2 this weekend. I mean, if I have time. I mean, I might not. I might wait a couple of weeks, but I like going to the movies, and I like the first one enough that I'll give this one a chance. But my expectations aren't very high.
See, no, I'm going to the movies this weekend. I'm going to go watch Inside Out with my girlfriend.
Oh, yeah. That's had a lot of great reviews on, like, Ted 2. I think it's, yeah, like, 100%,
it's
right?
It's 100% Rotten Tomatoes, I think, but it's 93 on a... It was 98 in Rotten Tomatoes, and it's a 93 on Metacritic right now.
That's pretty incredible right there. That's very good.
You want to hear a good story about this? I mean, not good, but a funny story about this?
Yeah, go ahead.
So apparently, they mixed up Inside Out and Insidious Chapter 3 at one movie theater.
Wow.
I'm going to throw that out there. Children probably who want to see Inside Out probably shouldn't have seen Insidious Chapter 3, which actually
looks genuinely
terrifying.
No, I think there were probably some nightmares. They're probably like, why would Pixar do this?
Insidious Chapter 3 also does have great reviews, but it looked kind of scary from the trailers, so interesting. I guess it follows the other one that has better reviews that also look kind of interesting from the trailers. But yeah, Inside Out, it's got Amy Poehler, Bill Hader, Lewis Black, Mindy Kaling, Phyllis Smith, and it's, I don't know, it seems really interesting. You have, like, all the different emotions.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, it definitely looks interesting. Looks like something, yeah, I mean, I'm not a huge Pixar guy, because I'm kind of a dark, cynical, mean person, but, but I mean, this one does look interesting. It looks like kind of a fresh idea. It looks like Pixar's maybe returned to top form.
Yeah, because Disney kind of, like, had a
little
slight,
bit of a lapse.
Yeah, since Up, I can't remember the last, like, really great Pixar movie. Unless Toy Story 3 came after that. I can't remember when that came up. But the way they did it, though, like, for this movie, it's like Amy Poehler's Joy. For anyone who sees Parks and Rec, that's perfect. Bill Hader's Fear, which just seems perfect based off what he was SNL. And then, you know, Gus is Mindy Kaling. Sadness is Phyllis Smith. Those both make a lot of sense. But my favorite one is they got Lewis Black for Anger.
That is a great one. Lewis Black's the man.
Just watch a, what's the movie called? It's the Accepted?
Yeah, yeah.
With Justin Long? Yeah, I love listening to Lewis Black on that movie.
No, I mean, Lewis Black, if you've watched his stand-up comedy, he's a very kind of angry comedian kind of style, and he definitely would fit anger very well in this movie. Even though his material on his stand-up is probably not appropriate for the crowd of a Pixar movie.
I'll have to mention it when we do the Hall of Fame next week, talk about movies. I'll let you guys know what I think about it.
I'm just really surprised you're not going to see Max this weekend. You liked Mad Max so much. Didn't you want to see the prequel, Max?
So I saw that trailer while watching Jurassic World, and my grandparents, like, they have military, you know, veteran, my grandpa, and then obviously they love dogs, so, like, my grandparents are going to absolutely, like, see that trailer and, like, oh, I can't wait to watch it, because I was thinking in my head, okay, who would want to watch this movie after that terrible trailer I just saw? Probably kids and old people who like dogs.
People who like boring movies.
Yeah, it looks terrible. It really does look terrible. It looks really terrible, and it seems like there's, like, a kind of...
It honestly looks like somebody's parody of an Oscar bait film to me. Like, if someone was trying to make an Oscar bait film the wrong way, that's how they would make it.
It seems like there's a lot of phony emotional resonance.
Like, imagine War Horse just gone to the extreme wrong. That's what I'm seeing in that. Basically,
like
it's
in
a spiritual
time,
sequel called War Dog.
I feel like in our spare time, we should write, like, the more, like, a phony, ridiculous version of War Horse.
Yeah.
Like, what the parody of War Horse would be.
Yeah, I would think it would be this movie.
So, a stat that I thought was absurd. So, Fallout Shelter came out during the E3 Bethesda press conference. I'm a big Fallout guy. I have an iPad.
And so,
an
you
iPhone.
Immediately went to the store and waited till it was available for download.
Yeah, and then I downloaded it, and I played it that night, and then I played it a couple times after that, you know? And you've played the game as well.
Oh, yeah.
But apparently, it's been played over 70 million times a day. What? Huh?
Yeah.
What?
That's insane. That is an insane number, but I will say, I mean, I've played it, and it might be my favorite free game on a phone that's been made. It's no surprise, because Bethesda is absolutely amazing at making video games, and them making a mobile game, they obviously would be great at that, too. They're
like,
good at anything. Anything they touch turns to gold.
But, like, I don't understand, because, like, I mean, I played a game. I thought it was fun, but I wasn't,
who would
like...
Who would want to play this game if you have no idea about Fallout? Like, for many people to play it, I mean, they're getting a lot of people playing the game who probably never played any other Fallout game before.
How much? They're probably gonna make more money off that dumb little mobile game than they will off Fallout 4, which is crazy to think about, but it's probably true.
I mean, this is probably the best marketing campaign for Fallout 4 I could imagine. Like, people playing this game being like, oh, I'm gonna play the new Fallout game. It's gonna be a lot like this game. They're gonna play it, and it's not gonna be anything like that game, but...
I keep trying to get the new Pip-Boy edition, special, the collector's edition for Fallout 4, and I have an alert for, like, whenever Amazon gets in stock, it'll tell me on the email. And I was at the gym today, and I got the, no, yesterday, I got the gym yesterday, and I got the alert on my phone, And I was like, crap, I have no idea what my new address is at Duke. And I tried to find it. And then by the time I actually found my new address was, they're all out again.
That's not good.
No, it's quite unfortunate, but, you know, it's interesting. Fallout Shelter, what are your impressions from playing this game? Like, what do you think about, like, just in terms of gameplay and the aspects of it?
I mean, at first when I was watching, you know, when I was, I think it was a little bit overwhelming at first to me as a mobile game, just all the things that you could do, all the features it had, all the little details, I mean, all the buildings you can make, having people coming to your shelter, having the fact that you can make kids in the shelter, sending people out to the wasteland, the different items, the different skills. I mean, it was a lot to really kind of grab a hold of if you're not, like, an active gamer. Which is kind of surprised to me, because, I mean, this is a game for a mobile game, and it's had 70 million, you know, you said 70 million, it's been played that many times
in a day,
and on average, so that means it's probably gone over that towards the beginning, but I was surprised at how, I mean, how people apparently must be addicted to this game, and it's really a pretty complicated mobile game. There's a lot going on there, but the craft of the game definitely has the trademark of Bethesda. Haven't had any problems with the game. It seems to seamlessly, you know, save and load, and it's addictive. I mean, they did the job, and it does a good job. I love the little references they have to the Fallout universe with the, you know, the special characters you could have coming with, like Sarah Lyons, the Rad Roach outbreaks. I mean, there's a lot to like in this game.
I mean, really, when it comes down to it, the only thing I really, you know, have a problem with this game is, it says there's like a 33% chance that, you know, it'll fail for when I rush things, and it's always
lying.
It's like 75% across the board, like, or at least 2/3 it fails, even regardless of what the percentage says. So that's, and you know, one of the missions you have at the very beginning, because there's like little goals you have to do to get lunch boxes or bottle caps. But one of them is complete your first rushed assignment, which they want. I guess they put that in there because they want you to, like, to rush something. Always fail
because
like
a disaster could happen.
And every
kind of
time a disaster does happen.
Yeah,
it's like, they asked me that at the very beginning, like, okay, this is a fun thing he wants me to do. And every time I fail first try, because I've made like 4 or 5 vaults now, because I'm trying to find ways to maximize like the efficiency of it. Like, I'm now using like two blocks in a row for like the, because if you have a power next to another power, it's a double one size.
Yeah.
So, yeah, well, they're more efficient that way. So I've been doing that instead of just once. I've been redoing it over and over again, trying to figure out what's most efficient. And every time I rush it, every single time, first try, it fails. Regardless of the fact that it says, like, 29%, 30%.
No, I mean, it definitely is frustrating when you're trying to rush that, and, you know, a fire happens or a rad roach outbreak. And also those pesky raiders, they kind of get annoying after a while. Because they didn't show up at first for, like, you know, several hours of me playing the game, probably aggregate. And then after they showed up once, they've just kept showing up ever since then.
It's like, hey, here's a vault. Let's keep attacking that vault, regardless of how many times they kill us.
Yeah, and they're kind of pesky for sure. But, I mean, I think the toughest thing that happened to me, though, is I sent Sarah Lyons, when she was, like, by far the highest-rated character I had. I think she was, like, level 44 or something when I got her, and sent her out to the wasteland. And I turned off my phone for a while, and I opened it up, and she's dead. And so I had to spend the, like, what was, I think it was, like 1,000 or 10,000 coins to get her back alive. I mean, I'm glad that you're able to bring them back to life for sure, but I mean, that was definitely something I was worried about, and I found out you actually have to completely exit the game for you to be safe. Like, you have to actually exit the game and, you know, cancel it and quit from the game. You can't just, you know, minimize your screen. The game will keep going.
What's interesting about that is, they, like I said, they have a bunch of characters from the different Fallout games in here. I think I got, the first one I got was Scribe Rothschild. But at one of my playthroughs, got Three Dog, which is awesome.
That's awesome. I bet he's great with charisma. Does he have a high charisma level? I'm almost certain he does.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's like a.
Because you can put him in your radio room, and you know, he'll probably get all the outlanders to come get you.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he's perfect in charisma, and then he's super high in luck as well. Interesting enough.
That is interesting.
But endurance,
I
want to
get
too,
Wadsworth. I wonder if Wadsworth is in the game.
I don't think he is, based off the last time I saw, but I'll check again one day. That'd be really fun. I'd love to have a Wadsworth.
He'd probably have a great agility ability, so he could go into the kitchen and serve people.
I need to replay Fallout 3. Now that, once we do the show, then for the Hall of Fame, I'll probably need to replay because I need to play Arkham Knight.
Hey, but you get
bit,
a free
probably.
Copy of Fallout 3 if you're an Xbox One owner with your copy of Fallout 4. So that works perfectly for you.
Well, talk about a game I already have, though, of course. So, like, I'm not really worried about that.
I wonder
that,
if backwards
cool.
at capability will let us play Fallout 3 on Xbox One, because that'd be very nice.
I realize that all the games they have right now were published by Microsoft, because even Mass Effect 1 was published by Microsoft. So all the ones preview guys can play right now. And I imagine, like I said, they will be, Fallout 3 will be available probably when the game comes out on backwards compatibility. That's probably what the plan is.
Yeah, I think so.
All right, well, last two things real quick. I just finished Dying Light. Very interesting game, because it's probably the... I had a lot of fun playing it. In terms of a pure gameplay standpoint, there's few games that are probably as fun as this one, especially when you unlock the grappling hook. You can really traverse in a way I've never done in any game.
No, I mean,
I had a...
This is a game I'm actually thinking about playing, too. I mean, I was looking at it. I saw it available at the store. I asked you about it. You told me maybe I should get GTA 5 instead of this game. We've been trying to improve my
collection. Choice.
Which it was, because
I
really have had a lot of fun playing that game. Very fun game. Never played a GTA game before in my life, so I'm kind of new to this thing, but it's a lot of fun. The driving's fun. The dialogue is addictive. I mean, the only thing I'll say is, like, some of the tasks that are involved are a little bit boring, but, yeah, sorry to hijack this from you, but GTA 5 is great. Tell us about Dying Light.
Okay, so, yeah, Dying Light, which is probably, at this moment, I don't think it's as good as, like, the two big RPGs in Dragon's Inquisition or Witcher 3, and I probably like Shadow Mordor more, and maybe you can make an argument for Wolfenstein, but it's definitely one of the best games to play on the Xbox One so far, not including remakes, because GTA 5 is the best game on either console, arguably. But, anyways, it's pretty much like an action, first-person action-based game. Kind of if you played Far Cry, it seems similar in kind of the interface, but it's not as gun-based, it's more weapon-based. You know, you have guns, but it's more weapon-based. The aiming's actually a little awkward besides because you click on the right stick to aim, which is a little awkward, but, you know, that's how it is. But it's at its core, though, it's a survival game. So at nighttime, for example, the infected get ridiculously powerful, and they'll chase you. So you actually get points, survival points, or because there's three main categories. There's one for survival, one agility, and one, I think it's power. And as you kill zombies, you get more power points, or even humans. If you traverse, like jump around a bunch and run a bunch, you get more agility levels, which kind of reminds me of Oblivion to a certain degree, where you just jump around everywhere.
Yeah, you improve your athleticism. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a lot of fun.
And then,
to manipulate
and then you
have
survival
that.
Points, which survival points are if you survive at night, if you complete missions, if you complete tasks, they give you survival points. And there's three different skill trees that you can build up your skill tree. And it's got a very unique crafting system where it's kind of complex, but it's also, you have a tower that's your base.
Huh.
And every day, the beginning of every day, the quartermaster has new supplies for you.
That's kind of nice.
And you kind of have to go there and get new supplies every day to a certain degree, or you won't have any medpacks, you won't be able to make any Molotovs, because they both use alcohol. You're going to be low on supplies, and the weapons are kind of cool, because you can give them upgrades, but then you can't remove the upgrades. But that's not... All this stuff I'm talking about is kind of cool, but like I said, the gameplay in itself is a lot of fun, and once you get stronger, more powerful, where like when you kill zombies, you get boosts, or like you get more attacks the more you attack... You have more strength the more you attack things. You could just start slaughtering a group of them. It's very cool throwing like a little firecracker that distracts in one area and then exploding them all with a grenade or a Molotov. It's and like I said, at nighttime is terrifying. This is one of the best. Like this and State of Decay are probably two of the best games I can think of that are incorporating making nighttime scary in a zombie game, making you not want to be out at
no,
night.
No, for sure. I mean, I've played State of Decay before, and I always would immediately go to the shelter when it hit nightfall and sleep for a few hours. Because, I mean, it was not worth going out there, but sometimes you have to. You have to go out at night sometimes, unfortunately.
I played a little bit of State of Decay on 360. I stopped playing it because I literally had just beaten Dead Rising 2 the day before.
Yeah, you're a little zombied out.
So I was like, yeah, I'll take a break. And I never really went back to it, but then I got the Xbox One edition.
Honestly, I kind of gave up on it because it was too hard. I don't have enough willingness to play a game like that that's going to frustrate me and scare me.
I'm going to play it again pretty soon, but it's... I'll just wait. Dying Light's not, in my opinion, like, it's not Witcher 3. It's not Bloodborne, and I haven't even played Arkham Knight yet, but I'm just going to assume it's not Arkham Knight, but it's definitely a hell of a lot better than the 74 Metacritic rating I see for it right now on the PS4, or the 74 on Xbox One, or the 75 on the PC. I think it's a lot better.
I mean,
better
we know
that.
Our fellow podcaster here, Brian, really liked the game, too. So
it's Brian's favorite game on the next generation, which, you know, he likes Far Cry 4, probably the second most, almost, I think. So he's really into gameplay elements, especially first person. So that's kind of where we differentiate. But my dad loves this game as well. It's a very fun game. I kind of found it repetitive, but other people have found it worth playing for... Because I got repetitive, but I didn't think it was repetitive in the sense like I didn't want to play anymore, got bored. It was just, I wasn't inspired to do much more once I finished, I guess. But both Brian and my dad both played the game a ton after they finished, so... Yeah, obviously this game came out in January, so we're kind of late here, but...
But Billy, a little post release review from you, so that's good. I mean, well, I like hearing the games you're playing, because I mean, you're kind of my person I look to whenever I'm looking to get a new game, because you've played them all. So it's good to have your perception on this, so I could maybe make it my next purchase.
Or
I can get
play...
Destiny the Taken King, but that probably won't happen because it's $40.
$40, which is the most absurd thing I've ever heard. But I've kind of I'm kind of the guy, I guess, that has to play all these games for this year.
Except for Destiny.
For our Hall of Fame, right?
Yeah.
I pretty much have to play all the good ones so I can kind of give my opinion. And assuming there's no remakes, I think I've done a pretty good job playing most of the big ones. So Arkham Knight, like I said, that just came out. I have that game. I'll probably start playing it soon. I beat Ori and the Blind Forest.
Heard a lot of complaints about the 100% completion ending in that game, by the way.
What about it? Like, how hard is it to do? Or, like, the ending itself? Or,
the
like,
ending itself. Like, the actual rewards you have from the cinematic and the ending. A lot of people have been disappointed in it. I'm not going to say why, just for, you know, for fear of spoilers here, but if you're interested to see why, look it up online. It's pretty interesting.
Are you saying people have 100% that game in 2 days?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. That's impressive. All right, and finally, before we close up the show, we're going to talk about Space War.
Yeah, Space Wars. Ain't that nice? Apparently, the U.S. military, in response to, like, I guess from doing some war games or, like, some think tanks looking at the threat of how space could affect the transportation of information and resources and, like, information through satellites mainly, they're building a new space center, Defense One, to simulate these war games and prepare for space attacks. So,
science fiction. You're telling me that Ender's Game is being done, so they're going to start recruiting the genius children for future training?
Yes, yes. It's basically going to be Ender's Game with Harrison Ford, the head of the military.
Oh, I love it.
And a disappointing take on the book.
maybe it wasn't that bad, all things considered, but that was probably my favorite book. Still, probably today, it's still my favorite book, probably. It was my favorite book growing up, for sure.
Yeah, I like to include a little bit of real-time news, even though we didn't get too detailed in it, because we're kind of running low on the show, but definitely interesting to hear about how things are progressing there, a new space war. So so if I take from that what you will. Look it up.
10 years from now. 10 years from now. We're talking about the cold space war.
Yeah, the cold space wars. But it's, I don't know, space war is just a cool thing to say. That's really why I wanted to say it, but...
Space war.
The funny thing is, like, the image here from IGN I'm looking at right now is an image of Sandra Bullock from Gravity as the headlining image for Space Wars.
Oh, that is funny. That is really funny.
Yeah, but it is kind of interesting to think about. I mean, you know, we have a huge information age going on where the satellites really do, you know, transport information across international lines and keep us in touch with all these other nations. It definitely is critical to prevent a takeover of that network, or, you know, gaining space superiority in the military. It's something that we, you know, people have thought about for years, ever since science fiction became on the mindset and we learned to fly and, you know, fly airplanes and jet planes, that it would eventually take to space, and maybe this is the first step in that happening. So makes you feel really small and insignificant, Billy.
Well, I mean, you could say it kind of reminds me of a certain DLC for Destiny that's going to cost $40 for some reason. I don't know why, but space. It seems like a really expensive way to do something. Yeah, it seems like a really expensive way to do something that we're not entirely sure what it's going to be exactly.
No, but it'll be worth it because of all the loot we're going to get from the moon. When we get when we take over space, you'll be able to go to the moon on your pike, you know, and fight the Hive.
It's very cool. It's very cool. I'm from Huntsville, which is the Rocket City, is the nickname of it. We have a space rocket center. Kids all go to space camp there. So to me, I'm always all for any kind of funding of any kind of space programs because it really makes you dream. And that's kind of what the point of space is, right? So we can kind of dream and imagine there's something out there that we can understand or life's bigger, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
We used to look up and think about our place in the stars. Now we just sit here and ponder about our place in the dirt. Great line from Cooper in Interstellar right there, Billy. Favorite movie of mine.
Isn't there a line from True Detective about how you used to want to be an astronaut?
Yeah, that was another great line. I love these, like, space lines. They seem to be taking over all the things I love. When I was a kid in school, I wanted to be an astronaut. But astronauts don't even go to the moon anymore. It's a great line.
What a depressing show, though. Like,
that is so depressing. I mean, what was the least, like, Seth pointed this out yesterday on the group meet, the least depressing thing that happened in the show was Paul Woodrow not killing himself.
That was
the most uplifting thing in that episode.
That really is the most... I can't wait to see what happens next. We're not going to talk about it for another 2 weeks because of the Hall of Fame, maybe a brief mention, but wow, I hope the show gets a little brighter.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of like that it's dark. I just hope that it gets, you know, the plot picks up a little bit and we get to see these characters interact. I mean, I'm sure there's going to be a little bit of light humor in there, but I mean, I don't really have much hope that this is going to become, this is not going to be the darkest thing we've seen in years. I think it is going to get probably darker.
But it's okay. We'll always have Space War.
Yeah, we'll always have Space War.
All right, Matthew McConaughey. We need to get out of here. We spent a lot of time, but I hope you guys enjoyed this episode without Seth. I'm Billy White.
And David Hunter.
See y'all next week, everyone.
I'm Seth Jr.